Chapter 6, The Hunt for Dracula. After Lucy's funeral, Mina contacted Van Helsing because he seemed to know much about her friend's death. After Mina heard the strange tale, she gave Jonathan's diary to him. This is how Van Helsing learned about Count Dracula and his arrival in England. After the vampire Lucy was killed, Van Helsing called Dr. Seward, Arthur, Jonathan, and Mina together for a meeting.
"We must destroy Count Dracula," he said. "He is a very strong vampire. When he forces someone to drink his blood, they become his slave. He is as strong as 20 men. He is very intelligent, and he can change his shape into that of a wolf, a bat, or even a fine mist that can move through the tiniest cracks. But he has some weaknesses. He can only move around during the night. During the daylight hours, he is confined to his coffin like the truly dead." Then Van Helsing turned to Jonathan. "You say he left his castle in Transylvania with 50 great boxes?" Jonathan nodded. "Then we must find all of these boxes and destroy them," continued Van Helsing. "Then he will have nowhere to rest and will become weak. He may even die." The obvious place to search was Carfax, the estate Jonathan helped the Count to buy. The men found it was more like an old castle than a mansion, with dank, smelly tunnels underneath. It was in these tunnels that the vampire hunters found Dracula's boxes. They opened each, and Van Helsing sprinkled holy water in every one. As he did this, he said a prayer. Finally, he put a sacred wafer, the same ones that are used in church to symbolize Christ's body, in each box. Before he got to the last one, however, the men heard something moving toward them. "We are too late," cried Van Helsing. "Count Dracula has returned."
The men spread out, ready to attack, but they trembled at the sight of the Count as he entered the room. He moved with a supernatural quickness. Van Helsing held up his crucifix, and the Count backed away. That gave the men the opportunity to run outside.
"Quick," said Van Helsing. "He knows we are on his trail. He may try to strike at your house, Jonathan. Mina is in danger."
They all rushed back to Jonathan's house and ran upstairs to Mina's bedroom. The door was locked, which Jonathan remarked was unusual. The men broke the door open, and a terrible sight met their eyes. There was Mina, in her white sleeping clothes, standing limply upright next to her bed. By her side stood a tall, thin man, clad in black. His face was turned from the men, but the instant they saw him, they all recognized the Count. With his left hand, he held both Mina's hands, keeping them away with her arms fully stretched above her. His right hand gripped her by the back of the neck, forcing her face down on his bosom. Her white nightdress was smeared with blood, and a thin stream trickled down the man's bare chest, which was shown by his torn open shirt. As the men burst into the room, the Count turned his face, and a hellish look seemed to leap into it. His eyes flamed red with devilish passion. Violently, he threw his victim back upon the bed, and then he turned and sprang at his hunters. But by this time, the professor was holding his crucifix with a fixed arm and chanting a prayer. The Count suddenly stopped, just as poor Lucy had done outside her tomb, and he cowered back.
"Ha!" he yelled. "You think you have defeated me? You know not that I have lived for centuries, and I will live long after your bones have turned to dust. And now the woman you love will become mine."
With that, he vanished in the shadows of the night.
"We must watch over her better than we watched over Lucy," said Van Helsing. "Tomorrow we will go back to Carfax and destroy the Count's last box."
Breakfast the next day was a strange affair. They all tried to be cheerful and encourage each other, and Mina was the brightest and most cheerful of all. When it was over, Van Helsing stood up and said,
"Now, my dear friends, we go forth to finish our terrible task. Are we all armed, as we were on that night when first we visited our enemy's lair?
The other men all assured him that they were.
Then it is well. Now, Madam Mina, you are in any case quite safe here until the sunset.
But before we go, let me prepare you against personal attack. I have myself, since you came down, prepared your bedroom by the placing of garlic, holy water, and sacred wafer, so that he may not enter. Now let me guard you. On your forehead I touch this piece of sacred wafer, in the name of the Father, the Son, and...
There was a fearful scream from Mina as soon as he placed the wafer on her forehead. The thin wafer burned into the flesh as though it was a piece of white-hot metal.
Van Helsing seemed quite dejected.
"Dear Mina, please forgive me," he said.
Then with a grim expression, he turned to the others. "Let us go and destroy this monster's last refuge while the sun shines."
While Jonathan watched over Mina, the other men returned to Carfax. However, they could not find the last box. Returning to Mina's room, Van Helsing said,
"Mina has a special connection to the Count now that she has drunk his blood. She can experience what Dracula is experiencing now, and vice versa."
Van Helsing hypnotized Mina.
"What can you see?" he asked.
"What can you hear? What can you smell?"
Mina spoke slowly, with her eyes closed.
"Everything is black and stuffy, like the inside of a box."
"I can smell the ocean. I can hear the sound of waves and of a ship being made ready to sail."
"That's it," cried Jonathan. "He's returning to Transylvania. We have succeeded in driving him away from London."
"Yes, that is true," replied Van Helsing. "But for Mina's sake, we must follow him and destroy him. If we are too late, Mina will suffer the same fate as Lucy."
It was decided that Van Helsing and Mina would travel together overland to Dracula's castle. Jonathan, Dr. Seward, and Arthur got passage on a fast ship to follow Dracula over the seas. Van Helsing and Mina arrived at Count Dracula's castle well before both the Count and their friends. It was very cold, and Van Helsing was worried about Mina. She would not sleep during the night. Instead, she sat in a sort of trance. And during the day, she slept so soundly that Van Helsing could not wake her. Only during the brief sunrise and sunset would she act like her normal self. This is what Mina wrote in her diary.
"In the late afternoon, I woke up. The professor signaled to me, so I got up and joined him. He had found a wonderful spot, a sort of natural hollow in a rock, with an entrance like a doorway, between two boulders. He took me by the hand and drew me in. 'See,' he said, 'here you will be sheltered, and if the wolves come, I can meet them one at a time.' He brought in our furs, made a snug nest for me, and tried to offer me some food. But even trying to put food near my mouth was repulsive to me. I wanted to please him, but I could not bring myself to even attempt to eat. He looked very sad, but did not scold me. Taking his telescope from the case, he stood on the top of the rock and began to search the horizon. Suddenly he called out, 'Look, Madam Mina, look! Look!' I sprang up and stood beside him on the rock. He handed me his glass and pointed. The snow was now falling more heavily and swirled about fiercely, for a high wind was beginning to blow. From the height where we were, it was possible to see a great distance. Straight in front of us, and not far off, came a group of mounted men hurrying along. In the midst of them was a long wagon, which swayed from side to side, like a dog's tail wagging. I could see from the men's clothes that they were peasants or gypsies of some kind. On the wagon was a great chest. My heart leapt as I saw it, for I felt that the end was coming. The evening was now drawing close, and I knew that at sunset the thing, which was inside that box, would be free. In fear, I turned to the professor. To my surprise, however, he was not there. An instant later, I saw him below me. He was drawing a holy circle in the ground around my position and sealing it with a prayer. When he finished, he stood beside me and said, "At least you shall be safe here from him." He took the glass from me and said, "See, they come quickly. They are whipping the horses and galloping as hard as they can." He paused and went on in a hollow voice, "They are racing for the sunset. We may be too late." Then he cried, "Look, look, look! See two horsemen follow fast, coming up from the south." It must be Arthur and John. I took the telescope and looked. The two men might have been Dr. Seward and Mr. Holmwood. In any case, I knew that neither of them was Jonathan. However, somehow, I knew that Jonathan was not far off. Looking around, I saw on the north side of the coming party, two other men riding at breakneck speed. I knew one of them was Jonathan, and the other was Lord Godalming, Arthur's friend from London, who so graciously came with us on our dangerous hunt. They, too, were pursuing the party with the cart. When I told the professor, he shouted in glee like a schoolboy, and then he laid his Winchester rifle ready for use against the rock. "They are all converging," he said. "When the time comes, we shall have the gypsies from all sides." I got out my rifle, for while we were speaking, the howling of wolves came louder and closer. The wolves were gathering for their prey. Every instant seemed an age while we waited. The wind came now in fierce bursts, and the snow was driven with fury, yet the sun still shone here and there. We were accustomed to watching for sunrise and sunset, so we knew with fair accuracy that the sun would soon set. Soon, we could clearly distinguish the individuals of each party, the hunted and the hunters. Strangely enough, the gypsies did not seem to realize, or perhaps they didn't care, that they were being pursued. They seemed, however, to double their speed as the sun dropped lower and lower on the mountaintops. All at once, two voices shouted out, "Halt!" One was my Jonathan's, the other, Mr. Holmwood's strong, resolute tone of command. The gypsies may not have known the language, but there was no mistaking intent. Instinctively, they pulled their horses to a stop. Lord Godalming and Jonathan dashed up to one side, and Dr. Seward and Mr. Holmwood went to the other. The leader of the gypsies waved them back, and in a fierce voice told his companions to proceed. They lashed the horses and sprang forward, but the four men raised their Winchester rifles, and at the same moment, Dr. Van Helsing and I rose from behind the rock and pointed our weapons at them. Seeing that they were surrounded, the gypsies gathered together. Their leader turned to them and said something at which every gypsy drew whatever weapon he carried, knife or pistol, and they held themselves in readiness to attack. The gypsy leader pointed first to the sun, now close near the mountain peaks, and then to the castle. He said something which I did not understand. As if in answer, all four men of our party threw themselves from their horses and dashed toward the cart. Strangely, I felt no fear, but only a wild desire to do something. Seeing the quick movement of our men, the leader of the gypsies gave a command. His men instantly formed a circle round the cart. I could see Jonathan on one side of the ring of men and Arthur on the other. They were forcing away to the cart. It was clear that they were bent on finishing their task before the sun could set. Nothing seemed to stop or even to hinder them. Neither the leveled weapons, nor the flashing knives of the gypsies in front, nor the howling of the wolves behind, appeared to even attract their attention. Jonathan's grim face and singleness of purpose seemed to overawe the gypsies in front of him. Instinctively, They cowered aside and let him pass. In an instant, he jumped upon the cart and, with a strength which seemed incredible, pushed the great box over the side to the ground. In the meantime, Arthur pushed desperately forward as the gypsies cut at him with their flashing knives. He parried them with his great Bowie knife, and at first I thought that he too had come through in safety. But as he sprang beside Jonathan, who had by now jumped from the cart, I could see that with his left hand he was clutching at his side and blood was spurting through his fingers. He did not delay, however, and through the efforts of both men, the lid of the box began to yield. The nails drew with a screeching sound, and the top of the box was thrown back. By this time the gypsies, seeing themselves covered by the rifles of Lord Godalming, Dr. Seward, and Van Helsing, had given in and made no further resistance. The sun was almost down on the mountain tops. I saw the Count lying within the box upon his earth. He was deathly pale, and his red eyes glared with the horrible vindictive look which I knew so well. As I looked, his eyes saw the sinking sun, and the look of hate in them turned to triumph. But in the instant came the sweep and flash of Jonathan's great knife. I shrieked as I saw it shear through his throat. At the same moment, Arthur's Bowie knife plunged into his heart. It was like a miracle, but before our very eyes, the whole body crumbled into dust and passed from our sight. I shall be glad as long as I live that even in that moment, there was in Dracula's face a look of peace, such as I never could have imagined might have rested there. The gypsies turned, and without a word, rode away as if for their lives. Those who were on foot jumped upon the wagon and shouted to the horsemen not to desert them. The wolves followed behind them, leaving us alone. Arthur sank to the ground and, leaning on his elbow, held his hand pressed to his side. The blood still gushed through his fingers. I ran to him, as did the two doctors. Jonathan knelt behind him. With a sigh, Arthur feebly took my hand in his unstained hand. He must have seen the anguish of my heart in my face, for he smiled at me and said, "I am only too happy to have been of service." "Oh God," he cried suddenly, struggling to a sitting posture and pointing to me, "it was worth it for me to die. Look, look!" The sun was now right down upon the mountain top, and the red gleams fell upon my face, so that it was bathed in rosy light. With one impulse, the men sank on their knees. From their lips came a deep and earnest amen, as they saw that the red mark that had been burned into my forehead was now gone. Arthur said, "Now God be thanked that all has not been in vain. See, the curse has passed away." And, to our bitter grief, with a smile and in silence, he died, a gallant gentleman.